WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. History is full of dark periods, eras in which things were done that we don't like to think about, but ignorance of history may condemn us to repeat it. And a certain amount of looking at uncomfortable periods can help us learn about our past and about ourselves. For several years, the exhibit Without Sanctuary, Lynching Photography in America, has been traveling the country, and now it has taken up residence at the Levine Museum of the New South. In this exhibit, the camera's lens is focused on the nearly 5,000 people who were executed by lynching between 1882 and 1968. Most of the victims were African American boys and men hung many times for minor or trumped-up offenses in what often became community events. It happened here as well. In that same period, this area witnessed 260 documented lynchings, one of which occurred in Salisbury and is the focus of a book by one of our guests this hour, Troubled Ground, by Dr. Claude Clegg III. In that book, Dr. Clegg revisits the violent episode in his hometown's history, one that made national headlines in the early 20th century. We'll talk about this incident as we go through the program today, but he joins us now by phone from Bloomington, Indiana. Welcome to the program, Doctor.
Thank you.
Very welcome. Also with us, Dr. Jeffrey Leake, director of the Center for the Study of the New South at UNC Charlotte's College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Emily Zimmern is president of the Levine Museum of the New South. Welcome
Thank
back.
You, Mike. Good morning.
You are credited with following this exhibit as it traveled around the country and for bringing it to the Levine. Why is this exhibit important?
It is important because it describes a chapter of American and Southern history that profoundly affected American society, and its legacy continues to reverberate today. It changed our country in so many ways, and the lynching period was used as racial intimidation of African Americans. They lost their right to vote here in North Carolina. A new constitution was passed. And for more than half a century until the Civil Rights Movement, they weren't actively involved in the civic arena. And more so, lynching touched people's lives and created enormous fear and was a major motivator in the great migration of African Americans out of the South. And we have chosen to bring the exhibition to Charlotte because our mission is to present the stories and history of the American South since the Civil War. And that includes the dark chapters as well as the celebratory.
Most of these lynchings occurred in the South, but not all of them occurred in the South, and not all were lynchings of African Americans. There were a number of white people in this.
Absolutely. Lynching has happened throughout history and in all periods. But in this particular period, it was really used as part of white supremacy campaign that looked at African Americans as somehow less than human. And it was an issue of power. It really reached its ascendancy in the election of 1898. After the Civil War, there was a period when African Americans very much participated in civic life, were elected to Congress, were elected officials. And then in the 1890s, there was a really severe economic downturn. And that alliance of called fusionist, where African Americans and less affluent whites had come together and elected many people to office and were changing in many places the face of the South, there was a major reaction against it. And some of the former leaders who didn't like that trend used all sorts of racial intimidation to drive a wedge between that biracial alliance.
As I read through parts of Dr. Clegg's book and listened to you speak, it seems to me that there are some parallels to what's happening today. I don't know whether it's driven by economic downturn, but there seem to be – there are fears of the other around the country.
Well, I think that that always happens in any time of economic distress. I mean, that's unfortunately the trend to scapegoat people. And we make no political statements. In fact, we are really inspired by two senators back in 2005, George Allen, Republican of Virginia, and Mary Lou Landrieu of Louisiana, who worked across the aisle because they had been inspired by the Without Sanctuary book and passed the first resolution condemning lynching in history.
There is this book, Without Sanctuary, which has exactly the same title as the exhibit. Are they are they companion pieces?
Yes.
Which
yes.
came first?
I think it's important that our listeners understand what Without Sanctuary, how Without Sanctuary came about. An antiques dealer in Atlanta named James Allen would travel flea markets across the South looking for items to sell. And he came across postcards, if you can imagine, of lynchings. And, I mean, he was so taken aback, he couldn't believe what he was seeing, but he began over 20-plus years to collect these postcards, and there would be horrific images on one side and on the back notes saying, "Dear Uncle Henry."
Dear Mom.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and he was so shocked. And so he collected this, and the postcards, or some subset of them, were first shown back, I believe it was 2000, in New York at a gallery with no historic context, and it just created an absolute sensation. Because people couldn't believe this had happened in America and not so very long ago.
Why the title Without Sanctuary?
Because the people who were lynched had no haven. There was no safety. They weren't protected by our American system of equal justice under the law. It was mob action outside the system that was to protect all American citizens.
And you say that the museum is bringing this, has brought this exhibit not to dwell on this chapter, but to provide a chance to learn, remember, and feel empowered to stand up against bigotry and atrocity in the future, and to ask the question, who among us is without sanctuary today? Do you have an answer to that question?
It's not our place to answer. It's our visitors. And we have been very much affirmed during this past week by the reaction of our visitors. We spent, Mike, more than a year in preparing for this exhibition, board and staff, and holding community listening sessions by how could this exhibition be a positive experience. And the what we heard were three major themes: that it was critically important to understand the historic context that had allowed this to happen, to provide ways for our visitors to respond to the deep feelings that are stirred by these horrific images, and to ask that question, who is without sanctuary today? And the museum is about asking questions and helping people reflect. It is not our place to always provide the answers, or rarely to provide the answers. We provide the historic context and allow individuals to look deep within themselves and reflect. And the response has been remarkable. During the past week, it's only been open a week, visitors leave saying, "I'm unsettled, I'm disturbed, but I'm deeply grateful for having had the opportunity to see the images and learn about this history."
The book, Without Sanctuary, has a foreword written by Congressman John Lewis, who was alongside Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during the height of the Civil Rights era and throughout the whole era, actually. And he says, "Many people today, despite the evidence, will not believe such atrocities happened in America not so very long ago." He calls this an American Holocaust. Dr. Leake, is this exhibit incontrovertible evidence that it did in fact happen?
Well, it certainly makes the case in very powerful and provocative and disturbing ways. And, well, you can't argue with the images that are on the postcards for those who would deny that African Americans experienced such brutality at home. And in fact, Dr. Clegg makes that case, or came to this, and he can explain it far better than I can, mm-hmm. by looking at the book, Without Sanctuary. That was the impetus for
Troubled Ground.
For Troubled Ground.
That is why you wrote Troubled Ground, which is the story about what happened in Salisbury, Dr. Clegg?
That is exactly right. It was while thumbing through the book Without Sanctuary back about a decade or so ago that I came across this image of men who had been lynched in Salisbury in 1906. I grew up in Salisbury during the late 60s and the 70s. I had never heard of any lynching, and certainly not this particular lynching that took place in 1906. So if you might be able to imagine my surprise that having grown up in this place, I'd never heard of this particular tragedy. But there was in this book, Without Sanctuary, a full page of this image that had not come to my consciousness during my childhood in Salisbury. And no one with whom I spoke with after seeing the image had seen it as well. I'd known about lynching. I had been, at the time, I was a history professor, and I taught U.S. history and African-American history. So I knew the history in a sort of general way, but not in a sort of personal way that I came to know it after seeing this image. And so it was a personal journey that I set out on to put the book together, to research this book, and to find out more about what had happened in my hometown. So, the book was absolutely essential to this becoming a much more personal history to me.
What is interesting and what is troubling to me about the Beyond Sanctuary, Without Sanctuary book, and I guess the exhibit as well, are not just the photographs of people hanging by the neck as the result of crowds stringing them up, but the crowds themselves gathered around these people who are dead or dying and having their picture taken.
Yeah.
Now, lynchings, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, were illegal, but these people who perpetrated these crimes are fully willing to not only have their pictures taken proudly, but printed on postcards and sent around the country through the postal system. Explain this to me.
Well, I think what we've tried to do at UNC Charlotte with the Center for the Study of the New South, with the conference that we've organized, is provide a context to explore those kinds of issues and questions. Emily indicated that the Levine's purpose is to ask the questions, to pose the questions, and part of our responsibility as an academic institution is to explore what the plausible answers are. You know, what was moving these people in these communities who, after a lynching, may have before or after a lynching gone to church or been involved in various activities that all of us historically would have participated
in. And some
in.
Of the notes on the backs of some, not all of these are postcards, but some of them that are postcards, some of the notes on the back of are celebrating this. They're bragging about they're being either a participant or a witness to this and what a wonderful day it was.
Right. These are ritual moments. And that's what's scary. That's what's so disconcerting, that while they engage in, it'd be different if it were one or two rogue people just acting very badly, but these are communities gathering together, and the question does arise, what's going on in their minds?
I think it speaks to the whole notion of what we were referring to earlier about the dehumanization, that part of what's in the exhibition as well are materials from that period. I mean, there's one that is a pamphlet that says the Negro animal or human. I mean, it clearly is dehumanizing a segment of our communities.
There's something else that I find disturbing about this, which we'll get into at the end of the break. This is pornography. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fisher & Phillips LLP, a national labor and employment law firm representing employers in North Carolina from the Charlotte and Columbia offices. Partner Mike Honeycutt and Fisher & Phillips on the web at laborlawyers.com. And the 65th Annual Craft Fair of the Southern Highlands, presenting works from 200 members of the Southern Highland Craft Guild at U.S. Cellular Center in Asheville, October 18th through 21st. Details at craftguild.org. Well, the presidential race isn't the only contest being decided this this November. In North Carolina, we will be electing a governor. In that race, of course, pits current Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton, the Democrat, against former Charlotte Mayor Pat McCrory, a Republican, and Barbara Howe, the Libertarian. We're going to try to talk to all three between now and November the 6th, but tomorrow we start with Pat McCrory for the hour. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, heartbreak and loss led a young woman to embark on an 1,100-mile journey alone, how she found herself while hiking the Pacific Crest Trail.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about an exhibit currently in residence until the 31st of December at the Levine Museum of the New South, Without Sanctuary, Lynching, Photography in America. There will also be a conference on lynching and the American South, October 11th through 13th at UNC Charlotte Center City Campus, which is open to the public. Dr. Jeffrey Leek is in charge of that. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio from UNC Charlotte. Dr. Claude Clegg is on the phone with us from Indiana, where I believe he's a professor at the university there. He's an historian and author of Troubled Ground, A Tale of Murder, Lynching, and Reckoning in the New South, a book about an event that took place in his hometown of Salisbury, which we'll talk about at some length in a while. And Emily Zimmern is president of the Levine Museum of the New South. The photographs in this companion book, which are many of the same photographs that are in the exhibit Without Sanctuary, are gruesome. But more troublingly, I think there's that famous statement by a Supreme Court justice saying, "I don't know what pornography is, but I'll know it when I see it." This is pornographic material as far as I'm concerned.
That's why the subject has been so enormously taboo. The images of what could be done to the human body are it's really tough to look at.
Because some of these people are not just hanging by the neck. They've been what they call in this book barbecued. They've been burned alive.
Precisely.
And they have been stripped, some of them.
And that is why there are no images in the materials that go out. But it is incredibly important, as Congressman Lewis and others have said, to bear witness to these atrocities, to reaffirm the humanity of the victims. These were individuals. They were fathers, sons, uncles, friends. And
there were some women.
And there were women. And there were victims of other races.
Right.
I mean, in fact, we received a package just last week from someone in Albemarle who was white and had a relative lynched in Arkansas. It is very much, whenever atrocities happen in history, we can't turn away because it's ugly, because it's essential to remember that history. And in the sense, as you started out, that it's not forgotten or repeated.
What was the impact of these photographs on the people of the day, the people who were not participants or witnesses to the actual event, but only saw them, only experienced this through photographs? Were these considered snapshots of the truth? Were they considered entertainment? Were they there simply to validate people's innermost thoughts? What was going on in the minds of the viewers of these pictures?
Well, I think all of the above that you have mentioned, and we can't iterate enough the way in which the black body, certainly in the 19th century, first half of the 20th century, is the place where certainly in the minds of many whites, that's where you act out all of your inhibitions. That's you can do to black bodies what you can't do to anyone else. And you mentioned the term pornography. That has been used to talk about the fascination in the 19th century on the part of whites with slave narratives, for example, because you could read slave narratives and see all kinds of things occurring that you couldn't talk about in polite society. The rape of women, sexual exploitation of women in slave narratives. That where else could you read about something like that. And so with lynchings, you have, again, access to black bodies that you can do anything to. You have, you can act with impunity, and that's what's scary.
Many might. Dr. Clay, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to add to, I think, those very smart comments that the two other commentators have made in regard to the technology. Camera technology was fairly new at the turn of the 20th century, the late 1800s, early 1900s. It had been around for decades, but it's still fairly new. And I think that, unlike today where we know that a lot of things can be done in regard to special effects and the things that can be done with cameras and video and the editing, a picture captured a sort of visual truth for people who saw these pictures. That is, it confirmed that something actually happened. And it was unedited, it was raw, it was real time for them, as close to real time as they could get. So a picture of a lynching confirmed that it took place, the fact that people were smiling, grinning, posing, suggest that many of these events were very much choreographed for the camera. People were playing to the camera. I'd imagine that the sort of back and forth dynamic between a crowd and the actual lynchers was fueled by the knowledge that this was going to be captured, it was going to be an image, it was going to be circulated, and people around the country, even around the world, could sort of in a vicarious way, witness the lynching. They witnessed it in miniature, it'd be on a postcard or something like that, so in a sense it was safe in so far as a postcard is not the same thing as being there or seeing a full mural of a lynching. But I think the camera, the photography, gave lynching a sort of modern veneer as well. This is a modern technology capturing what many would believe to be a sort of pre-modern or barbaric thing and bringing it into the 20th century. So I think that the commentators are exactly right that this is a kind of pornography, but it goes hand in hand with a kind of modernity. The first full-length motion picture this country produces is Birth of a Nation. Birth of a Nation in 1915, I believe, and it has a lynching scene in that film. So that says a lot, I think, in regard to how race and racism are bound up in a sort of modernist vision of what race should be in this country. But at the same time, it shows a desire of people to project onto the images that they see that, you know, this is a visual truth, this is a reality, and that, you know, Uncle Henry or Aunt Sally was actually there because they're in the picture, because they're posing for the camera, because they're smiling. This actually took place, and it is real. And I think that gives it a certain sort of cachet for a lot of people, a certain sort of value, the fact that this is photographed, and again, at that time, anything on film, anything captured by a camera was actually the real thing to be experienced.
Mm-hmm. Mike, you asked how did people respond. There was a whole spectrum of response. There were many anti-lynching advocates and activists who tried desperately to get state and national legislation passed. And that story is also in the exhibition.
Mm-hmm. There were some children lynched, but far more children, it seems to me, in the crowds. There were a lot of kids watching these lynchings. Why? What would today, I think most parents would be loath to allow that. They only let their children go to the funeral of their grandmother sometime. Now we're watching a murder take place in these pictures.
Well, that's what makes them so horrifying in many ways. I mean, I think parents take their children to events that they think are significant.
And that's, to learn something from.
Exactly. And one thing that we do in the exhibition, again, based on the listening sessions we held for over a year, is to ask questions. And one that has proven incredibly moving for visitors is, can you imagine yourself in the picture as a bystander, as the victim, as a member of the mob, as the photographer, or as someone who chose to stay home that day? Sure. And it really causes all of us to think about, where do we stand? Right. Or where would we have stood?
No, and just to add on to what we've been talking about, it really, those images bring home the fact that this is a community endeavor, that it's not right. just one or two people. It's the community, different aspects of it coming together for, you know, a moment, a ritual moment of violence and brutality. But that's what's so unsettling.
And they're not wearing sheets over their head.
No.
They're in full view of their neighbors.
This is what we do. And then this is how those children you're talking about are socialized.
Right.
So it makes sense that it takes as long as it does for us to advance politically, socially, economically in the 20th century. I mean, it makes Jim Crow, it makes sense that Jim Crow lasted as long as it did.
Dr. Clegg, in your book, Troubled Ground, A Tale of Murder, Lynching, and Reckoning in the New South, you say that even in the West, which had a fairly well-developed legal system, lynchings were perpetrated by people who believed in more justice and less law. Out West, what were the perpetrators of lynchings trying to address that they felt the law wasn't addressing?
I think that in the period before the Civil War, in many parts of the West, you actually have fairly undeveloped legal systems and small settlements, not much in the way of a court system and ways to legally adjudicate conflict. So people take it into their own hands. Your horse is stolen by a horse thief. And that was really a quick way to get yourself lynched. The sort of the equivalent of stealing someone's car to take their horse is even more significant than that, since the horse could also be used for agricultural labor, transportation, and so forth. Because there was very little in the way of legal recourse in some areas of the West, a lynching served or stood in the place of a legal proceeding, and often those involved in the lynching of, let's say, a horse thief, they would go through the motions of a trial and a sentencing phase and that sort of thing, and then lynch the person. Over time, as more places in the West become less frontier, and there are actually settlements and towns and a legal system, I think you see a less frequent incidence of lynching. It still occurs. And it is still the case that people think that justice is something that needs to be handed down immediately. We don't have time to wait for the sheriff or the trial or jury to be assembled. People think in very local, immediate ways about justice. And that's one way of understanding lynching, not only in the West, but in the South as well. Even in the late 19th century, as we have Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina, coming into being. We have a much more elaborative system of criminal justice, appeals courts, and so forth. There are still people who are thinking that's not quite enough. It's not quite enough to wait for justice to run its course, for the defendants in a case to have their own legal representation. We, the community, in which this crime took place or this alleged offense took place, are the ones that should be imposing justice. And it should be immediate justice. It should be justice before the eyes of the community, before the eyes of the victim's family. It should be final justice as well.
Taking the law into your own hands. There's a photograph in this book, and I don't know whether it's in the exhibit or not, of Leo Frank. Leo Frank is a Jewish man from Atlanta. Actually, he came from New York, went to Atlanta to run a pencil factory in the early 1900s. There's a whole play about this, a wonderful Broadway musical called Parade. And he is, I think, essentially pardoned at some point for this alleged murder that he committed of a factory worker, which I don't believe he committed. Pardoned by the governor, put in jail for his own protection, brought out of the jail by a crowd, they then lynch him.
The Leo Frank incident is in the introductory film.
Okay. So these are people who want to take justice into their own hands. The justice system, in this case, they considered to have failed them. What kinds of things were considered crimes worthy of lynchings? What did it take? What did it take to get you lynched?
Wow, there's a whole slate of things, really an endless list. It could be arguing about wages. It could be talking back to a white person. It could be joining a labor union. It could be accused of staring, gazing, speaking to a white woman. It could be wrong place at the wrong time. Certainly a charge of murder, assault, rape of a white individual could get you lynched as well. And then again, there were instances in which it wasn't necessarily the case that an individual person had been accused of some crime. So it wasn't a question about individual guilt or innocence, but the larger lesson that an individual lynching was communicating to the larger community of whites and blacks.
So would the majority of these alleged offenses not have been enough for the legal system to react, and therefore you knew that the legal system couldn't or wouldn't do anything, so by gosh, you will? Is that what was going on here?
Well, one of the pieces in the exhibition that I think has really touched visitors is we have on a panel, and I'm looking at them. I mean, there are probably two dozen or more offenses, and we ask the visitors, have you ever done one of these, or do you know someone who's done these? I mean, and there are things, vagrancy, which at the time means simply not having a job, theft, gambling, insults, I'm trying to look at some that quarreling, just simply having an argument, at times self-defense. I mean, there's a list of all of these. It's not simply that you're being put to death because you killed someone. And often it wasn't. I mean, it might simply be...
Well, if you're having a quarrel, it was obviously a quarrel, but at least in these incidences where an African-American is being lynched, was it a quarrel between a white person and a black person?
Dr. Clegg can reference a dispute, I believe, in the case in Salisbury that happened long before any lynching. Isn't that right, Dr. Clegg?
That is exactly right. It was a quarrel over wages between black sharecroppers and their employer. That is as simple as that, a quarrel over how much each side of the equation, employer and employee, would get from sharecropping, which ends up in a lynching. But also there's a charge of murder against those individuals who are involved in the dispute. That is, the black sharecroppers accused of murdering this white family. But that was actionable cause. That is, if you were in a dispute with a white person, it was assumed that the white person was being the truthful party, the black person was the party that's been insolent, unreasonable, and so forth. So as minor, in our view, certainly a thing as that could get you in some deep trouble.
Now, Congressman Lewis, who writes the foreword to the Without Sanctuary book, says investigators frequently found no easily ascertainable reason for these lynchings, except perhaps white emotional and recreational starvation.
And
we had
fear.
We had nothing to do, and so let's go have a lynching? Really?
On occasion, I think that if you dug around deep enough, the fact that most of these things don't go to court. So cases in which people are lynched, people are taken out of the jailhouse, but they often don't get to court. So we don't have a legal record of what happened. We don't have the testimony of those individuals who were lynched. We don't have testimony from those individuals who did the lynching.
And with that, we have to take a break. I have to stop. I'm sorry. We'll come back and finish on the other side, Dr. Clegg. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Levine Cancer Institute, part of Carolina's healthcare system, offering hope to those battling cancer by focusing on advances in cancer prevention, detection, diagnosis, and treatment. Details at levinecancerinstitute.org. And Sedgefield Interior Landscape, specializing in interior plant design, installation, and continuous maintenance for businesses. Information available at sedgefieldinc.com. Heartbreak and loss led a young woman to embark on an epic journey. Cheryl Strayed describes how she put her life back together while hiking the 1,100-mile Pacific Crest Trail alone. That's in 20 minutes at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Hello, it's Garrison Keillor reminding you that A Prairie Home Companion is heard at 6 o'clock on Saturday, 12 noon on Sunday, right here on 90.7 WFAE. Hope you'll join us for music and comedy and, of course, the news from Lake Wobegon. Saturdays at 6, Sundays at noon on listener-supported WFAE Charlotte's NPR News station.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Jeffrey Leek is with us in our studio along with Emily Zimmern. Dr. Leek is from UNC Charlotte. Emily Zimmern is the president of the Levine Museum of the New South. Dr. Claude Clegg joins us. He's an historian and author of Troubled Ground, a tale of murder, lynching, and reckoning in the New South about a lynching that took place in his hometown of Salisbury. He's joining us from Indiana. Incidentally, as you join us from Indiana to talk about this, Bill from Matthews writes, I recently became aware of the lynching of two blacks that occurred in my hometown of southern Indiana, not too far from Bloomington. It took place in the early 20th century as a result of a miners' strike. The two victims were hanged from the marquee of a local movie theater. To my knowledge, no photos of this event exist, but it raises the question for me, what is known about the backgrounds of the people who took the images that are on display? Were they photojournalists, Klan sympathizers, bystanders? What do you think was the motivation for taking these photographs? This is before iPhones, where everybody is carrying around the camera in their pocket. If you had a camera, you were most likely to go, what, a professional photographer? I don't know.
Dr. Clegg?
I would say a camera was a pretty precious commodity in the early 20th century. It was very unlike today, where any of us can bear witness with a cell phone camera or a camcorder or an iPhone or whatever. They were very expensive, one. Secondly, you couldn't just snap a picture, you know, in a moment's time. You had to set up the camera. It had to be very still. You had to have usually some covering over the head of the camera operator, so as not to, you know, overexpose the film. You couldn't develop it there on the spot, of course. So the images of lynchings were are images that took some time to actually set up. People had to be still so that it wouldn't blur. Motion blur was very easily something that would occur if people moved. So to see a picture of a lynching meant that usually a professional, a person, one who could afford a camera, two, could operate a camera, was there on the spot, was there ahead of time, almost knew what was going to happen, had been called upon to take images of this event. So it wasn't a case that you sort of chance took a picture at a lynching or the camera guy just sort of chanced upon a lynching. These were very much choreographed, and again, people were taking these pictures are almost always professionals and work with a newspaper or some other organization that could afford a camera and a person who could operate it.
So where was the law in all this? Was law enforcement a complicit bystander in all this? Were they in agreement with what was going on? Were they simply incompetent? Did they lack the knowledge that this? Were they afraid of coming up against the crowds who were their neighbors and friends in some cases? What was the story about with law enforcement in all this, if lynchings were illegal, which they were?
Well, I think you. No, exactly. I think all of the above, and Dr. Clegg talks about that even in his book about how even in Salisbury, when attempts were made to protect black men who were accused of certain things, the mob won out, and that's the dilemma that we found ourselves in, and it's this. And you can find this in African American literature, the way you were talking about how they choreographed, or how Dr. Clegg was talking about how lynchings were choreographed and staged, and time was put into the images that were eventually produced. That's why, certainly in the literature of black men in the 20th century, in the fiction of black men, you find elaborate depictions of these kinds of moments, and for many black characters, lynching is the coming to the awareness of the possibility of lynching is a ritual moment. You have to be told certain things when you become of age so that you can hopefully survive.
Let's go to a call here from Roscoe in Charlotte. Welcome, Roscoe.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I just had a comment that I had always heard that the word picnic came from those community afternoons when they had picked a nick and people brought their baskets out and had dinner and stuff, you know, and watched it.
So a nick being an African American.
Right.
So they all came to the lawn with their picnic baskets and watched the lynching and ate and had a good old time.
Mm-hmm.
You've all heard of this.
I haven't seen it. I haven't read it, but I have heard that anecdotally that was what picnic meant. Yeah. And, of course, Nick being a derogatory term for black people, but I haven't seen it documented.
Okay. Roscoe, thank you for your call. Irwin in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Great program. Very gruesome, but great. I read in the paper yesterday that out in Seattle or somewhere, the empty chair from the Republican convention that stood for Obama is being used in hanging in trees, lawn chairs hanging from trees, and the people who are doing it say they see no racist undertones in this. I just was shocked. I almost couldn't understand what I was reading when I first read and thought of the image.
Any comment?
Well, that speaks to how lynching in particular produces a certain kind of fear, and that's what it's used for. Because you could kill someone, you know, in a more standard way, but whites understood that lynching had a certain power and sent certain messages to whites and blacks that we're going to maintain the racial order.
This went on. Go ahead.
One of the examples given in the exhibition that Dr. Hanchett developed at the museum is a lynching in Lake City, South Carolina in 1898. President McKinley had appointed an African-American postmaster, and during the white supremacy campaign, his house was set on fire, and rather than burn to death, he, his wife, and six children came outside. He was shot and killed. And one of the bullets killed an infant daughter. And then 50 years later, when Reverend Delane of the Courage Exhibit was organizing and filing the first lawsuit to end school segregation, he was told, "Do you remember the Lake City postmaster?" And that speaks very much to what Dr. Clegg and Dr. Leek are talking about as examples of lynching as intimidation and making sure you remember your place.
Irwin, thank you for your call. This went on for 200 years. It was not just the in the South, and it was not just in that populist era, which I want to talk about in a second, but it went on from the beginning of the Republic. It went on prior, when we were just a colony, just a group of colonies. What, after 200 years, what made it stop?
I think a number of things are going on in the 20th century in particular that don't necessarily end lynching, because there's still a stray lynching now and then. There was one in 1998 in Texas where a man named James Byrd was dragged behind a truck to his death, which was a popular style of lynching even in the early 20th century. So occasionally, even at this late date, there's still rumors, and not necessarily just rumors, but actual episodes within our lifetimes, within the last couple of decades, in which a style of murder that's reminiscent of a lynching comes to our attention. But I think what's happening is that the South in particular is becoming a less parochial place, a place that's under scrutiny of the rest of the country. The South is trying to attract capital and investment and industry, and capital wants stability. That is, those who are going to invest want stability. They want to know that if they're going to set up a factory or shop or invest in some facility in a town, that a lynch mob is not going to tear through the place and burn up things or chase off workers. or give the company a bad name. So, one, I think that the region is opening up in a way that lynching makes it look particularly bad. And the resistance to it is mostly a top-down resistance. It's governors, it's business people, it's journalists who turn on this first. And again, I think there are some humanitarian, certainly, motives here. But it's also an image motive, and it's also an economic motive. So there's a kind of southern boosterism, wanting to present the place or the region in its best light, again, to attract business, to attract capital, and so forth, to develop a region of the country that had been historically underdeveloped. And lynching was cast as something that was not something the New South should be involved in.
Well, this uptick in lynchings, and you talk about this in your book, coincided with the populist movement of the 1890s, which led to the disenfranchisement of African Americans. They couldn't vote anymore. They couldn't hold office anymore. The rise of the poll tax coincided with this. Literacy tests became ways to keep people from voting. Other means to limit African American participation in political life were in place. And with all these limits in place, why were lynchings necessary? Why was there an uptick in all of this?
I think that Ms. Zimmern touched on it earlier in our conversation. This is a holistic approach to race relations. That is, lynching is piece of a larger assault, a multi-pronged assault in regard to structuring race relations in a way that protected white privilege and white prerogative. That is, keeping people from voting is a way of ordering the political cards, keeping people segregated in systems, exploitative systems, sharecropping, and debt peonage, et cetera. But there were still people who resisted even those things. And what do you do with the person who insists upon voting or the person who insists upon arguing with their employer over their wages as a sharecropper? What do you do with the person who won't sit at the back of the train or won't sit at the back or comes into the restaurant anyway, even though there's a sign that says for whites only? Lynching was that last line in which people were clearly designated, that is, you belong and you don't belong, or this is what we're prepared to do to protect white privilege and prerogative, and this is your place. If you cross this line, you could be killed. How better to demonstrate the power of white supremacy and white privilege, how better to demonstrate black powerlessness and subordination than to make it a life and death situation or life and death proposition? So lynching dramatized more than anything else white power and black powerlessness, and the lengths that people would go to protect that. And again, the fact that law enforcement officials and others would allow lynchings to take place oftentimes, I think says something about the power of this particular mechanism of white supremacy to run roughshod even over the law itself. So I think lynching is part of a larger configuration or larger mechanisms for configuring race relations, and it's that last line. If you insist upon voting, if you insist upon arguing with your employer, if you insist upon X, Y, and Z, this could happen to you, and it will happen publicly, and it will be a lesson to the rest of the community as well.
Stephen from Charlotte writes, I've heard some locals refer to the large old tree in Fourth Ward on Settlers Lane as a hanging tree. What role did Charlotte have in this horrific piece of American history, and was this old tree the site? Did we have lynchings here?
We did have lynchings. I don't know if that was a hanging tree or not. Jeffrey, there were two or three known lynchings here in Charlotte, but the details are sketchy, and that's why we didn't use those as examples, because there wasn't the documentary evidence to tell the full story as there is in Salisbury.
Steve in Statesville joins us now. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Thank you very much. I listen very often. I wonder if there was any research done in that there are actually probably more white people lynched in the South over crimes and such than black people. And number two, I had understood that the last lynching occurred in Pickens, South Carolina in 1946, where the people from Greenville County over a murdered cab driver came over and got the man out of jail in Pickens County and out of the jail and lynched him. Some crimes are so obscene that sometimes the people react, and I'm not saying it's good, but there are, we have so many things like this happen in our society that, I tell you, I don't care if they're white, black, Chinese, or what, some people need to have that happen to them. It's just outright murders and rapes and such, but... you have a very interesting program.
All right, Steve.
Just one point of historic information. During this period, 73% of the lynchings in the U.S. were African-American men and boys. So during this period, it was not a majority white.
It also seems to me that there can be no condoning this kind of activity,
right.
Period, because...
We are a nation of laws, exactly. And we stand for equal justice under the law.
And if there is no law, we're animals. Larry writes, if our economy again takes a severe downturn, could such acts as these or similar type acts happen in today's society? Possibly the victims would also be Jewish, atheist, Muslim, etc., with the excuse being such folks would be the ones destroying our society. We're kind of witnessing a kind of resurgence of populism, are we not?
To a degree, and I think the point that Emily made earlier about the question that's raised in the exhibit, who's without sanctuary now? All right, what groups, what are your, when you visit the exhibit, right. When you leave, when you finish, what are you thinking or who are you thinking about in terms of people who may be without sanctuary? And of course, that's broadly conceived. It's not saying we're going to start dealing with lynchings, per se.
The exhibit, Without Sanctuary, Lynching Photography in America, will be in residence at the Levine Museum of the New South here on 7th at College through December 31st. There's a conference on lynching in the American South held by Dr. Leek, October 11th through 13th at UNC Charlotte Center City Campus, to which you are invited, and to which Dr. Claude Clegg will be a guest.
October 11th, that evening, Dr. Clegg.
We're out of time.
Thanks.